Hello and welcome. You're listening to Writers Aloud, a podcast brought to you by writers for the Royal Literary Fund in London. Hello and welcome to episode 275 of Writers Aloud. In this episode, Alison Hallett tells of how her words came to be carved in stone and laid down in a pavement in the centre of Bath. Then Donny O'Rourke pens a testament to the enduring and evolving nature of Glasgow tenements, stone stoics in a city that endlessly cannibalises itself. First, here's Alison Hallett with Written in Stone.
I remember being in a bad mood. I had applied for a commission to write text for a public art project in Bristol. A line of words, poetry or prose or both, would be installed by the docks for a couple of months. It was an interesting idea, and I was keen to do it. When I heard I didn't get the commission, I was dismayed, distraught. You know that tumble-down feeling you get when you've sent your imagination out in front of you, only to find that it slams into a brick wall instead of sailing into the place you'd dreamed for it. Friends offered platitudes to console me. Don't worry, there's something better waiting for you. And what's for you won't go by you. I listened, and I did not believe. Then, one day, a phone call. A sculptor was looking for a poet to collaborate with, and my name was one of several that had been put forward. I met Alec Peaver for lunch in Café Rouge. We chatted for hours about politics, family, friends, journeys we'd made to other countries, places we'd like to visit. We laughed, ate lunch, drank wine and coffee. In the last 5 minutes, Alec asked about my work. He wanted to hear what I thought about writing a poem that would be carved in stone and laid down in a pavement in the centre of Bath. This thrilled me more than the commission I didn't get. It was way beyond anything I'd done before. It was daunting, and I wanted it. I'd grown up in the town of Street in Somerset and walked past a Henry Moore sculpture outside the factory where my father worked every day on my way to school. I didn't have to think about art in public places. It was obvious, essential, as necessary as the air we breathe. How did I feel about writing a poem that would live in a public space? I felt as if I was born for it. A collaboration is a delicate, robust, joyous kind of thing. If it's going to work, there has to be a spark, a resonance between you that feels strong and fun and inviting. There has to be an ease, a way of being that means you can set off on an adventure together to discover something that doesn't yet exist. I liked Alec Peaver from the moment I met him. He was warm and friendly. Integrity oozed out of him. There wasn't a shred of pompousness in him, and he was astonishingly humble for an artist who had trained with Richard Kindersley, one of the great letter cutters of the last century. I had already enjoyed collaborations with dancers, composers, and a photographer. I liked this way of working. It cut across the solitary practice of being a writer and took me and my work into spaces that demanded flexibility and an increased visual and auditory awareness. I loved taking poetry off the page and seeing it become part of a performance or installation. This would be different, though. This collaboration would involve having a poem carved into stone and installed in Milsom Street in the centre of the iconic city of Bath. I did a lot of research. How the city began, the myths and stories of its creation, the ingenious presence of the Romans, the goddess Minerva, the temples under the city, the hot water that gushed out and stained the stones with its red ore, Jane Austen and Mary Shelley, the physical location of the pavement and the way it looked directly out to the hills beyond. The place where the poem would be cited was a point of connection between city centre and surrounding countryside, between goddess and human, language and stone, pavement and pedestrian, nature and the built environment. Once I was full of information, I sat down to write. It was laboured, painful. Everything that emerged was a mishmash of interesting things, but none amounted to a poem. The research had not cooked enough. It hadn't transformed into something that was more than the sum of its parts. Waiting for this transformation to happen is fine when I'm not working to a deadline, but when there's a definite date for submission, I have to make it happen sooner. I took off for a day and went to Chalice Well Peace Gardens in Glastonbury, paid my entrance fee and wandered around in the shelter of the beautiful gardens. Distraction is sometimes vital, as it means I can forget what I am trying to do, and forgetting can be an integral part of writing, especially after gathering a lot of research. After a couple of hours, I lay down in the sunshine and fell asleep by the burbling water that poured out of the earth, again staining the stone with red ore. When I woke, 20 minutes or so later, I scrabbled for a piece of paper and started to write. The words were urgent, pressing against me in their need to pour out. One word led to another. The words became phrases, the phrases stanzas of a poem. A couple of days later, I sent the poem to Alec. He liked what I had written and set about designing how he could carve it into the paving stones. Before another step could be taken, though, we had to gain approval from the commissioners of the work, the representatives of Bath City Council and the local MP. It was a tense morning. We entered the room knowing that the future of the work lay not only in the way we presented our ideas and the poem, but also in whether or not they liked what we were doing. If they didn't like it, the project would be scrapped and we wouldn't get paid. Everything was in the balance. A strange confidence came over me that day. I talked at length about my research and the ideas that informed the poem. I felt as if I was walking in shoes that fitted me well, that were strong, designed for scaling this kind of mountain. I knew that I couldn't have written anything better, that whatever happened between me, the city, the upsurge of water and the upsurge of words had come together in a magical way. This, more than anything, is what I trust when a poem comes, the inexplicable urgency. A poem that rises up out of the cauldron and insists it be written down. A couple of weeks later, I travelled to Alec's studio near Oxford to see my words being carved into stone. After sketching the poem on paper, Alec transferred the design onto the paving slabs. Each one was then lifted onto an easel and carved. One of the things that struck me most about this process was the sound, the dull thud of mallet on chisel, the repetition of this, and the faint ring of metal as each letter began to emerge and the smooth surface of stone gave way. This was writing as music, the hands of the carver, the tools, the repeated rhythms. These slabs of limestone were from a quarry in Italy. They were millions of years old. Watching Alec work, everything slowed down. Stone hauled from the belly of the earth meets an edge of metal. This makes a noise, the birth of sound at exactly the same time as the birth of a shape. That shape a letter, that letter a part of a word. It was spellbinding. It was the beginning of language being uttered without human breath. It was the curved body of an S, the dip and rise of an M, the straight trunk of an I. As Alec carved, I saw the bodies of letters as I had never seen them before. They were living things. They emerged from sound, and they inhabited shapes that transmitted meaning and resonance. Alec carved the script of the poem in a curvy, flowing font to echo the torrent of water running underground that gave rise to the city of Bath's fame as a spa. In addition to the main poem, four single words were carved in different places along the length of Milsom Street. This was a playful, mischievous addition. Little clues for anyone who happened to look down as they strolled along. "What's that doing there?" they might ask. "Wave. Star. Thank you. Why are these words beneath our feet?" When the work was completed, the council produced a leaflet, but to this day there is no plaque beside the poem. Nothing to say who carved it or who wrote it. The poem arrived in the pavement and came to live in the centre of the city without saying how it arrived or why. We liked this anonymity. It was important to us. We wanted the poem to find its own life, to be a part of the stone, to inhabit the pulse of the city and evolve with it. In effect, we wanted it to be as natural and present as the pavement itself, to take up residence without needing to declare where it came from. The meaning of the word poetry, which derives from the Greek poesis, is to make. We were makers, in the same way that the builders of buildings and roads and bread were makers. After the opening ceremony, I didn't go to Bath for 8 months. I felt exposed, nervous. This work was in the public eye and couldn't be hidden. It was also a poem that I couldn't edit, couldn't rub out, couldn't change in any way. It was carved in stone. It was there in the bright light of the sun, and it was there to stay. When I did go back, I spent hours watching people move over and around it. Most adults didn't notice the poem. They rushed on to meetings, to shops, heads held up or glued to a phone. Children and older people were different. They slowed down, stopped and read what was carved beneath their feet. I asked some of them what they thought, and more than anything, they felt a sense of wonder. I also learned that on Friday nights, a burger van pulled up and parked next to the poem. Late-night revellers ate their burgers here and sometimes vomited the contents of their stomachs over it. The poem has a life of its own. Pigeons walk over it. Globs of chewing gum punctuate it. Rain pours down and pools in the incised letters, and the letters become bird baths. I love all of these incarnations. Each one adds to the poem. This is language that lives in the midst of things. It has been taken off the page and breathed into stone through the hands of a sculptor, through the music of a mallet hitting a chisel again and again. When I walk over the poem now, I feel as if words have fallen out of my pockets and landed on the ground. It puts wings on my heels, a little lift, a little gasp as I walk over it. I look back and see that maybe the platitudes that my friends offered to me were true. There was something better waiting for me, and not all things are meant to be. I feel incredibly lucky to have been published in stone, to have one of my poems carved into the heart of the city where I now live. It's a democratic way for language to inhabit the world. The sun and moon shine on it. Winds blow over it. Sometimes people stop and read it. Perhaps it reads the soles of people's shoes as they go about their daily and nightly business. These words live under the feet of people and prams, pigeons and poodles, planes as they fly overhead. The texture of language informs the movement of the day. It's there among everything else that's going on, part of the orchestra of life. People often ask if I carve words into stone myself. I answer that I've never been tempted to do this. Alec Peaver is a master carver, and it has taken him decades to develop the skills he now practices with such apparent ease. This is what I love about collaboration. It means that people can come together with their respective skills and passions and make something else come into being, something we could never achieve on our own. 18 years after meeting Alec for lunch, we're still working together. His children have grown up and left home. Ideas have shuttled back and forth between us. New projects have been conceived and born. Alec has carved my poems into boulders, slabs of slate, and chunks of limestone. Our words written in stone now live all over the world, including a retreat centre in America, a housing estate in Kew in London, by the shores of a lake in Australia, and nestled into a grassy bank on the sacred Isle of Iona.
That was Alison Hallett, recorded by Jane Draycott. You can find out more about Alison on her website at alisonhallett.com. That's Alison spelt with a Y and Hallett with two T's. Next, here's Donny O'Rourke with Tenementality.
I shouldn't be here. No, I didn't have a near-death experience. It was Glasgow that almost died, bulldozed into oblivion. This large, lovely, light-filled flat stood in the way of progress, or more precisely, the path of a proposed motorway approach road. It was the early 70s and the promised land could be glimpsed just across the flyover. One local woman said no, repeating her protest reverberantly enough for it to be heard above the boom-bang-a-bang of a great Victorian city being blown up and torn down. Community has become a term so vacuously ubiquitous that there is probably a community. Anyhow, that campaign helped meld one into existence here in Woodlands. Underdogs versus underpasses. Plucky, as cliche insists all underdogs must be, but doomed. The bound to prevail arguments of the councillors, construction companies and other vested interests. She demolished them. Here's to you, Mrs. Henderson, whose objections stood, and so did the tenements, their smoke-smudged sandstone restored to glistering gold. An old grey city going blonde, as I was to put it a decade or so later in a poem in praise of these stairs and their stories, urban living standing tall and for, density and intensity, but immensity. Tenement town with its layered landscape of vertical villages became a metropolis missing in inaction during a war the evacuees weren't aware was being waged, whose battle plans were on draftsmen's drawing boards. Whatever perfection was, you wouldn't find it up a close. To cement the deal, the sky was scraped and pastures paved over, schemes peripheral in every sense. With the lowest rate of car ownership in Britain, a city of labyrinths and lanes, courtyards and closes would overtake history in the fast lane to the future on the UK's most extensive network of infra-urban roads, from alleyway to motorway, overnight. Many were gleeful, some were sceptical, most were docile, only a few woke up and smelt the exhaust fumes. Cinderella City did go to the wreckers' ball, as she had a century before. Glasgow is the cannibal that eats itself. Only two medieval buildings are extant. A college founded in 1451 was flattened for a station, a freight depot. They reused the stones from the cloister in its construction. A neo-Gothic university was erected in the newly developed West End. Glasgow got a Victorian makeover. and the tenement walls came tumbling down. Those tenements, woebegone warrens of unmitigated want, almost unimaginably overcrowded, rat, disease and crime-ridden, slums rank, dank and squalid enough to shock and shame the city fathers into eventual action, these hutches and hovels had to be cleared away. Thanks to the City Improvement Trust of 1867, brass plaques now stipulated the maximum number of inhabitants for each remaining edifice. Municipal socialism brought gas, light, clean water and humanely habitable space, indoors and out, to the city's poorest quarters. What could and should be saved was saved. Sound buildings were refurbished, unfeasibly minuscule lodgings combined to form adequate, if still cramped, accommodation. Things in such new or renovated single ends and room and kitchens were scarcely cosy, far less rosy, but at least tenements were no longer lethal. This was the sepia cityscape that became classic, iconic, mythic. Almost exactly 100 years later, those by now long forgotten lessons were not relearned. Denniston to the east is almost as close to the city centre as Woodlands is on the west. There too, activists prevented their homes being razed, invoking the example of the Improvement Trust to trust improvement, and knocked down inner walls rather than entire buildings. 45 years on, it's an attractive mix of the trendy and the traditional. Not as hip, hot and happening, however, as funkily fabular Finiston, which is separated from where I live by Kelvin Grove Park, another testament to Victorian vision and verve. When Glasgow town was falling down, dozens of viably venerable tenement neighbourhoods never got the chance to be as fashionable as Finiston, to whose chic mystique I propose an avocado toast. Closes are cool, mostly. Physically, it's quite tricky for a snob to look down on a tenement, but my, the snooty try. When a friend's daughter, precious in every way, was house hunting recently, tenement was invariably imprecated as if denoting a particularly bad smell. And historically, fragrant tenements were not. In ancient Rome, which gave us the word, throughout the old town of Edinburgh during the Enlightenment, between the sun-starved stoops of New York's Lower East Side, as the old world's immigrants streamed in, housing, high-heaped, cheerless, if cheap, put roofs over dream-filled, weary heads. When buildings are packed and denizens stacked, remaining aloof isn't really an option. Tenements didn't do privacy. Yes, neighbourhoods need neighbours, and for Glaswegians, almost aggressively friendly by habit and repute, indeed vocation, this really was a gospel truth. A wee hing, whereby women from adjacent or facing flats would wind up the window sash for a good communal gossip, fish supper shared with the even hungrier children across the landing, borrowed sugar and milk. A transgressor, failing the as-thyself test of stare-heed propriety, would be subject to a shericking, a public reading of their delinquent character, verbal tar and feathers. The Debrett's-like rigidity of the etiquette regulating the cleaning of stairs, use and upkeep of outside lavatories, and order of precedence at the communal laundry or steamy, these rituals have passed into legend and lore, and thence into popular culture. That masterly collector and composer of folk songs, Adam McNaughton, could lay claim to being the laureate of tenement life. Ye canny fling pieces oot a 20-storey flat, 700 hungry wains will testify to that. The ease of throwing and catching jam sandwiches is indeed a compelling reason to insist that 4 stories remain high-rise enough. Another McNaughton lyric is entirely devoted, literally, to singing the praises of tenement values, mores and customs. Oh, where is the Glasgow where I used to stay? The wee Wally Close is done up with pipe clay. Like hings and turns for the stairs, pipe clay has had its day, but our lobby is tiled in precisely that elaborate and gentility-affirming manner, though only to the first landing. I'm on the second floor. Appearances were not kept up. We just got plastered. Adam's lament is undeniably sentimental and nostalgic, Brought up in Douce, decent Denniston, he is much to mourn and miss. His tribute to witness and solidarity, more ups than downs, so to speak, was scathingly parodied by Jim McLean in a ballad excoriating the appalling poverty, the sordid impoverishments of every moral and material sort, caused and made worse by damp, drafty, crammed contiguity, condemned, and justly so. As is usually the case, the city's posher parts endured no pile-driven depredations. Gapsite and dynamite were for the lower orders, a poor show. Let the drum beat a forlorn retreat for each sacrificed street, abstract plans made concrete to reduce beloved arts and parts to rubble, socially engineered ash from which the only phony phoenix to arise was a never-ending, lung-blackening traffic jam in the world's first drive-through city. Nothing to see here. Robert Moses had recently flattened Hell's Kitchen to create the heaven on earth that is the Lincoln Centre. Robert Bruce, no, the, was Scotland's post-war king of conurbation. A con, to be sure. Only a last-minute casting vote voided his disaster plan for Germania on the Clyde. The tall towers that did get to harass the horizon have mostly been blown sky high. Our council thought the demolition of a few surviving tower blocks on live television would get the Commonwealth Games off to a suitably explosive start. The tact and taste of the citizenry ensured sense was eventually seen. Glasgow became the tragic punchline to a joke told by a mirthless double act. The cynics, intent on making money, names and power bases, had as their straight men idealists who wanted to start again, building from scratch a modern megapolis worthy of a Le Corbusier, or more sinisterly, a Speer. A futuristic fantasy in which little plastic citizens made way for little model cars. Utopia's walkways and precincts would be paved with good intentions. Nobody heard the or in motorway. In Lauriston, Tradeston, Springburn, Port Dundas, Blackfriars, Parkhead, Shettleston, Carlton, Brigton, the urbanishers didn't even need the excuse of my way and the highway. Tenement Town was destroyed but not obliterated. We still have the words, the names I honour now. Town Head, where the Glasgow Irish worked and stayed and played and prayed, where Joan Airdley had her studio. Cowcaddens, locus and focus for the wild painterly and literary energies of Alistair Gray. Maryhill, a bombsite blitzed not by the Luftwaffe, who were busy enough here, but by politicians. Gorbals, home to successive waves of immigrants from Ireland, Eastern Europe and Pakistan. Carlton, Bridgeton, Govan, where on the banks of the Clyde the dear green place was first to flourish, put on the vellum map by monks. Tenement Town worked. Those who toiled here lived near the forges, foundries, factories, shipyards, machine shops, locomotive sheds, tram terminals and steelworks that employed them. When we got rid of the employees, the employment soon followed, though the globalised jobs had further to travel than the breeze block El Dorados erected without amenities on the city's outskirts. Beware houses for the permanently unsettled. Decanted was the favoured euphemism, as if poured out and sniffed, swirled around in this place, displaced and misplaced tenement dwellers would open up and breathe like vintage wine. Still, they could always visit the museum, excellent in every regard, a tenement TARDIS poignantly evocative of its tenant and her time. It's in Garnet Hill, a 10-minute stroll from here. The stroll is not quite the right word, since to get there by either walkably navigable route, you have to traverse the moat of motorways, passing under or flying over, a perambulatory inconvenience to the road lobby and the Baileys and planners in its thrall. My father spoke often and piningly of the stores and trams and theatres, pre-museum tenements and life that I cannot recall. In 1901, The awe-stricken mayor of Chicago sent a delegation to study Glasgow's municipal miracle. They stayed 3 months and took the city's head of transport home with them. These apartments were built that wondrous year when Glasgow, sizing up a new century, was in its progressive prime. Peak tenement, one might nowadays say. I spent my undergraduate years in this same building, living one level down on the preferred first floor, as the estate agents simperingly insist. When I came back to Scotland from London, youth politics and television, I moved initially to York Hill, another tenement quarter subsequently absorbed by the aforementioned Finiston. Back then, avocado was a colour for bathroom suites. En route to directing my first television film, I was tossed the Herald by the electrician in the front seat. It was open propitiously at the property page. The airy, lavish flat I'm writing in and about now was available at a price I couldn't afford and was anyway much too big. But I put in a bid. Mine was not the highest offer, but my former neighbour, perhaps remembering small student kindnesses and courtesies, wanted me to have it. That was in 1985, and I was 26. Then heritable proprietors predominated. Today landlords do. Our conservation area is surrounded by offensively featureless, purpose-built student accommodation, the purpose being profit. Many a noisy night, it's like living in an unwardened hall of residence. Tennis stars in saris lobbing backhands at the bins, my paean poem again. When I was studying, Woodlands was popular with Pakistani families. Some have stuck around, many flitted to the leafy suburbs. Yet Woodlands is in leaf, the cherry blossom late and past, nature's confetti now. But the urban glade that runs the length of the street, so green and shady, sets off the lush-petalled, spring-sprung cameo gardens that line the pavements. And from the cafe terrace where I sip a gentrified espresso, I can see my window boxes bud and bloom, planted the other day by a nurturing neighbour. And I can see something else, the plaque and prestigious awards that commemorate the indomitable woman who just said no. The dry docks may be obsolete, but we're still tied up in the paradox. Glaswegians love to ironise their ironies. Mrs. Henderson, a Tory in a left-leaning town, forced Labour to conserve. Her flat and the memorial above her door are directly opposite what we hoped would become a little community arbour. A sylvan and pastoral space, rather than a branch of Tesco and the block of flats thrown nondescriptly up as part of the planning package, a so-called development that the council whipped through despite vehement objection, a reverse she did not live to witness in the neighbourhood she rescued and transformed. If you will permit me, that much anthologised poem again. God, Glasgow, it's glorious, just to gulp you down in heartfuls feeling something quite like love. The ghosts aren't gone, nor is what their dwellings stood for. This city's determined desire to live lovingly together, to care and share, to be fair, to thole and thrive, to laugh, aye, adding a wee bit of cheek to the cheek by jowl. That's a timbre, a tone, a take, an attitude, a style, a way of being, a tenementality, if you like.
That was Donny O'Rourke, recorded by Conor McPhee. You can find out more about Donny on the RLF website. And that concludes episode 275, which was produced by Conor McPhee. Coming up in episode 276, Courtier Newland speaks with Catherine O'Flynn about taking inspiration from TV and music, diversity in publishing, and his multi-genre career. We hope you'll join us. You've been listening to Writers Aloud, a podcast brought to you by writers for the Royal Literary Fund in London. To subscribe to podcasts and to find out more about the work of the RLF, please visit our website at www.rlf.org.uk. Thanks for listening.